You are listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You've reached Reality Sandwich with Julie Matthews. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living, and you're listening to our radio show, Reality Sandwich, where every Thursday we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on mind, body, and the planet. And you can listen to any of our past shows free, downloadable on the internet on our website, realitysandwichradio.com. And you can find out more about us at healthfulliving.org. So hopefully today on our show, we will talk about the opposite. Instead of abuse of power, we will hopefully talk about freedom and our desire to create freedom with what we're able to eat and not eat. And so I think this is a fairly fascinating subject, because you'll be surprised at the regulations that government comes up with to tell us what we can and cannot eat. And so today I have on the line with me Sally Fallon, who is the founder, president, and treasurer of the Weston A. Price Foundation. She is a journalist, chef, nutrition researcher, homemaker, and community activist, and she's the author of a very, very popular book called Nourishing Traditions, the cookbook that challenges politically correct nutrition and the diet dictocrats, and her newer book, Eat Fat, Lose Fat. And Sally should be with us today, and we're going to be talking about applying these principles, these nutrition principles, for pregnancy and healthy babies. So let me see if we can get her on the line. Sally, are you there?
Yes, I am, Julie.
Hi, Sally.
How are you?
Good, thank you. Well,
go ahead. It's interesting that you talk about abuse of power and its opposite, which I guess would be freedom for everybody and to live a happy, healthy life. And it really does start with the health of our children. And an unhealthy population whose resources are being drained by disease is not going to be a population that can work to make sure that their freedoms are maintained. That's for sure.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And then when we start to talk about some of the foods that were available to us traditionally for generations, we're now going to see that things like raw dairy are now illegal in many states, and there's a law that if you make yogurt, it has to be made with pasteurized milk or it's not allowed to be sold. So just even a few things like that, not only can we not defend our freedoms if our brain isn't working and we don't have the energy.
And nutrition has a lot to do with how our brains work.
Absolutely. So we are here today to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is healthy children, and that, of course, starts with healthy pregnancy and healthy infants. So maybe we could just start a minute just by talking a little bit about some of the principles. I know a lot of your work is based on Weston A. Price, and for those people
right.
who don't know of him, he was a dentist in the 30s and 40s who went around to a bunch of traditional cultures that still were able to live the way they did traditionally for centuries and kind of look at what was common between those cultures and what kept those people healthy. So I would love to, if you could just maybe start a foundation here about what were some of those things that Weston A. Price discovered.
Yes, he traveled all over the world. He visited 14 traditional cultures. And he was a dentist, so he was looking at their people's teeth, and he found 14 cultures with excellent dental health, that is, virtually no cavities, but also beautiful broad faces and straight teeth. So these bodies were very well built, very strongly built. And one of the interesting things he found was that there was a great deal of attention in these communities to food for pregnant women. Even before women got pregnant and the husbands or the partners, they had special diets, both men and women, before conception. And then during pregnancy and lactation, and then during the growing years of the child, there was this recognition that you needed special, really nutrient-dense foods for this period of time. And these were not vegetarian foods. All of these special foods were nutrient-dense animal foods, such as organ meats, liver, cod liver oil, butter from the grass when the cows were eating the grass when it was at its best, cheese, raw milk, fermented foods, and also lots and lots of seafood.
Mm.
Eggs was another one. In fact, eggs, for example, eggs are a sacred food in China, and a pregnant and nursing woman, if she can afford it, will eat up to 10 eggs a day.
Wow.
And they're considered a brain food. I've had Chinese people tell me this. Our grandparents made sure we had plenty of eggs or fish eggs.
Mm.
So we would be smart, so we'd be good at arithmetic.
Hmm. Fascinating.
And you know, what I love, the thing that gives me a thrill, is when science validates these seemingly baseless traditions. And we know now, for example, that choline is just essential for the development of the brain. And if the baby is missing choline at certain windows of development, connections will not be made, and the baby will not have optimal development. Now, what are the two best sources of choline? They're egg yolks and liver. And in many cultures, these were the first weaning foods for babies.
Interesting. In our culture, every time I mention liver to people or organ meats, they wonder what they are, because they can't believe we're actually eating them, and then they turn their nose up. So for those people that haven't eaten them, why would they want to?
Well, if you do a nutrient comparison with just, say, muscle meat and organ meats, in most categories, the organ meats are 300, 400, 500 times denser in minerals and vitamins than the muscle meats, and 1,000 times denser in nutrients than fruits or vegetables. This is where the nutrients concentrated in the animal. Liver was a sacred food in many cultures. Now, a lot of people don't like liver, but there's wonderful ways to eat liver. You can eat pate, you can eat have it in sausage, you can eat it as scrapple, liverwurst, these types of things. And we used to eat these types of foods. And not only that, Julie, but doctors recommended pregnant women to eat these types of foods.
Mm.
Now if a woman is pregnant and she goes to her doctor, he'll tell her, don't eat liver because it's toxic or because you'll get too much vitamin A or something.
Right.
And that vitamin A is actually essential for the right and proper development of the infant. When the fetus is in the womb, it's vitamin A that tells the stem cells what to do, how to differentiate themselves, how to become a heart or liver or lungs or whatever. And if you're lacking in vitamin A, then you're going to get abnormalities or just suboptimal growth in these organs.
Let's talk a little bit about vitamin A, because I know there's a lot of controversy. People will tell you, in fact, the food pyramid will claim that carrots have vitamin A and all these plants have vitamin A. So can you distinguish that for people?
Right. That's one of our most important messages at the Weston A. Price Foundation. What's in the plants is not vitamin A. The FDA lets the food industry call it vitamin A. But if you go to a biochemistry textbook and look there, you will read that vitamin A is only in animal fats. It's not in plant foods. Now, all animals, including humans, can convert some vitamin A, some of what's in plants, which are the carotenes, into vitamin A. But the humans don't do this very well. It's a difficult process for us, and many humans don't do it at all. And to get adequate vitamin A, we need to eat these foods that are rich in vitamin A.
And what about children? I heard that for children, that conversion is even more difficult.
That's exactly right. Children don't make this conversion at all, and that's why children need more vitamin A as a function of body weight than adults. And we recommend that pregnant women take cod liver oil, and they start giving it to their children when the children are weaning from breast milk. Of course, they should be taking it while they're breastfeeding as well. It's just, we can't stress the importance of this enough, because this is such a key nutrient for the development.
When do children start to have that conversion process, or up until when do they not make that conversion?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. It comes online slowly. It requires a lot of digestive enzymes to do it, but you know, a good clue is when the baby or the child starts taking an interest in vegetables. And this is my theory, that the reason children, babies, don't really like vegetables very much, and they sort of have to be forced on them, is because they can't do much with them. Mm-hmm. Their digestive system is immature, and they need everything ready-made and pre-made for them. That's why milk is so wonderful, because everything is ready to go for the infant.
So let's talk about that then, because this is, so two of the things you mentioned were fermented foods and then raw dairy products.
Right.
So, and these two, especially raw dairy, is the one, what is the one thing that every single nutritionist, doctor, any expert, quote expert, will tell you never to do during pregnancy?
Just to drink raw milk.
Right.
We recommend a quart of raw milk every day for pregnant women.
Wow.
And nursing women. And it should be raw milk from cows eating green grass, nature's perfect food, to get the calcium you need, to get the vitamin A you need, the vitamin D, all the minerals. And, of course, the beauty of raw milk is that your body doesn't have to do any work to assimilate the nutrients in the milk. All the enzymes for doing that for you are already there. So it's a wonderful food for pregnant mothers. One of the things that's in raw milk is vitamin B6, and it's completely destroyed by pasteurization. And B6 is very important for preventing morning sickness and toxemia. So it's a key nutrient that you get from raw milk. And then when the baby, gets old enough to drink from a cup, you can start them on raw milk. Never start them on juice. It's just the worst thing that you can give to a child.
Mm-hmm. So for people that are wondering what we're even talking about, because most people have never even heard of this, raw milk is unpasteurized milk.
That's right.
And we in California are lucky because we're one of the only two states that allows the legal selling of raw milk on a retail basis.
Actually, now, that's not quite true. There's seven states.
Oh, great.
Where you can now buy it in stores.
Ah.
But it's widely available in California. There's two dairies in California doing this, and so you're very, very lucky in the state of California.
And the milk is delicious.
Oh, yes. It's just nothing like it.
So let's talk more about that, because this is the subject that always understandably causes the most confusion, because the CDC and everybody has such strong warnings. Why was pasteurization originally created, and why is it now not helpful to us?
Well, back in the 1800s, there was the milk was being produced in the cities in confinement dairies where the cows were eating the swill from brewery production, which is a totally inappropriate food for cows. The milk was so watery that people added chalk to it to make it look white. It was absolutely filthy. And the death rate of children in inner cities was 50%. And it was recognized that this was caused by the milk. Now, two solutions were proposed. One was to pasteurize the milk and supposedly get rid of all the germs. The second one was the certified raw milk movement, which was started by a doctor in New Jersey, Henry Coit. And that was where doctors found farms where things were clean, where the farmer was healthy, where the animals were healthy. And then they certified that milk and brought it into the cities. A third thing happened around about the same time was they outlawed the swill dairies. So pasteurization takes credit for the decline in the death rate in the children, which occurred after that, but it really wasn't necessarily pasteurization at all. Then after the Second World War, various states started passing laws making pasteurization mandatory. And little by little, the raw milk producers were squeezed out for one reason or another. They weren't organized. They didn't have a lot of power. Very often the dairy inspectors would swoop down on a small farm and shoot all the cows because they said the cows were sick or something. And the farmers had no recourse. Mm. Now, the interesting thing is that raw milk is coming back with a vengeance. We have a website, realmilk.com, and our list of sources of raw milk throughout the U.S. is pages and pages long. So we're very pleased about that.
Wow. And so what is this new information that everybody's finally figuring out and causing them to go back to the raw milk?
Well, we've dug up a lot of old studies in which animals fed on raw and pasteurized milk were compared, and the ones on raw milk were much, much healthier. We have new information on human milk, and we've learned that raw milk, human or goat or horse or whatever, is full of antimicrobial compounds that kill bad bacteria. And these are all destroyed by pasteurization. And if you look at the government's own statistics, you can figure out that it is over twice as likely that you will get sick from drinking pasteurized milk compared to raw milk. And I'll give you an example. In California, organic pastures dairy has been in operation since 1999. And no one has ever gotten sick from their milk. They've had over 40 million servings since 1999. since that time. During the same period, there have been at least 19 recalls of pasteurized milk products just in the state of California.
Wow.
You never hear about them. If anyone who's drunk raw milk gets sick for any reason, it's immediately blamed on the raw milk. But you never hear about the hundreds of thousands of people who get sick every year from other foods.
That is unbelievable to
yeah.
me.
Well, you were talking about hiding things and corruption.
Right.
Yeah. And there's definitely a double standard, when you talk about raw milk versus other foods.
Sure. So I guess the bottom line on that and the thing that people might want to check out, or I encourage people strongly to check out, is that realmilk.com website, because there's all sorts of information on what the benefits are of raw milk and the safety. And so
yes.
people can get much more educated and comfortable on their own to make that decision.
Right.
So in terms of just, let's go to fermented foods then, because this is another thing that any bacteria in our culture is the enemy. And it's so interesting, since we would die without good bacteria. We literally could not live without
That's
good bacteria.
That's right. In fact, there was an article on the front of Newsweek a few weeks ago by, I think it was a Dr. Gordon, who has found millions or billions, I don't know, of bacteria in the gut. And these bacteria have many important roles. They digest our food. They help us absorb minerals. They have neurotransmitter qualities. They make feel-good molecules. They get rid of waste. They protect us from pathogens. So what once was, like the basis of medical practice, that germs were bad, now we understand that most germs are good and that we absolutely would die without those germs. It's interesting that the FDA had this Fight Back campaign, which was Fight BAC, like bacteria. And we're getting everyone to use antibacterial soap and all this, and they've had to kind of back off of that, because what's happened is the antibacterial soap gets in the water and creates resistant pathogenic bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this pathological fear of bacteria, and we really need to get over it. And by the way, a baby who's nursing, drinking raw mother's milk or raw, cow's milk or whatever, will be programmed to be immune to whatever bacteria it comes in contact with. And there was a fascinating study I found where they were looking at milk banks in China, at mother's milk banks, and they tested the mother's milk, and it was just swimming with pathogens, absolutely loaded with pathogens. And then they found out that there's a custom in China for mothers who have given birth not to bathe for a whole month while they're nursing. And what this does is program the baby to be immune for life to whatever it comes in contact with.
Wow.
So that contact, that exposure to germs for babies is good if the baby's drinking raw milk. If the baby's not drinking raw milk, then the baby can really get in trouble.
Right. Mm-hmm. So in traditional cultures, there's a great wisdom there, because every culture that I can think of uses fermented foods as an important way of getting nutrients in their diet and keeping digestion going and all of those things. Can you give some examples for people of what some of those foods around the world are?
Well, the one that people recognize most easily is sauerkraut, which is a fermented cabbage. Now, I'm talking about unpasteurized sauerkraut made by this process called lactofermentation, which produces lactic acid. The lactic acid preserves the cabbage. It's a preservative, but it's something that's good for you. And at the same time, all sorts of enzymes and good bacteria proliferate in the sauerkraut. Everyone's into probiotics these days, taking pills to put good bacteria mm-hmm. in their guts. But our ancestors did not have probiotic pills.
Mm-hmm.
They were eating live foods. Actually, I call them super raw foods, because they've been fermented to greatly increase the nutrient content. Now, sauerkraut's just one. Yogurt, properly made yogurt, kefir is another one. You can ferment fish to make gravlax. You can ferment beets to make pickled beets. And these cultures also had beverages that were lacto-fermented, healthy soft drinks.
Hmm. It's amazing. And one of the things you were sort of alluding to is that the reason that there's all this bacteria, but that it's not harmful, is that the good bacteria lives in harmony with us, and we sort of need each other, and so they actually have compounds that kill the bad bacteria that's bad for us.
They absolutely do. They absolutely do. Really interesting story about Africa. Now, in Africa, they have a beverage called sorghum beer, which is made by lacto-fermenting sorghum, which is a grain. And it's definitely an acquired taste, but it's a pretty foxy taste. It's very low in alcohol and just very rich in probiotics. And in Africa, it was the custom for mothers to give this to their babies when they were weaning them. It was like inoculating them against disease and filling their intestinal tracts with good bacteria. Now, because this beverage was just slightly alcoholic, when the missionaries came, they told people not to do that. And so this wonderful protection that they had from the beginning was taken away. Mm. It's interesting to me that when Price was in Africa, when Weston Price was in Africa, he never observed the types of infectious diseases that we associate with Africa in the ones that he studied, the ones who are eating traditional foods.
Talking about fermented food for pregnancy, so I'm assuming pregnant women should eat fermented foods.
Yes.
I don't know, thoughts, comments?
Well, there's many, many things you can ferment. You can do carrots, you can do beets, you can do make a salsa, fermented salsa, you can do cabbage, of course. What I would suggest is people go to my book, Nourishing Traditions, and what we did in Nourishing Traditions was create a way that is easy, that doesn't require a lot of equipment, and that's pretty foolproof.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make these in mason jars right in your own kitchen.
And it, knowing, I've done this myself, and it's quite simple. So
yes.
It's magical, but it's not as complex
it
seems. In fact, for people listening, I am teaching a cooking class on how to make fermented foods
good.
And talking about some of this stuff on June 10th, so you can check my website.
Oh, very good. And, you know, the beverages are not that hard either. You can do ginger ale.
Mm.
You can make drinks with orange juice or pureed fruit. And they're lacto-fermented, and they're really nice.
Great.
Not hard, yes.
So I know that during pregnancy, one of the benefits of fermented food, besides all the things that we talked about, is that babies get their first exposure to good bacteria from the mother in the birth canal, and so it's important for her to populate all that good bacteria and get a good balance going. So I'm assuming
Right.
People out there listening, that fermented foods would definitely be something very important to eat during pregnancy.
Oh, absolutely. I think they would help digestion for the mother. And you're absolutely right. What these lacto-fermented foods do is they keep yeast down. And you don't want baby coming through the birth canal when you have a yeast infection.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is very important for the baby to get that inoculation right at the start, either from the actual birth or from the breast milk. And one of the things that we're finding is that the autistic children have gut dysbiosis. They don't have the right kind of bacteria in their intestinal tract.
Mm-hmm. I could definitely tell you from personal experience that probably almost every autism client that I work with has poor digestion and typically serious dysbiosis.
Right, right. So this is raw milk, of course, is a wonderful way to get those good bacteria in there, if they can tolerate milk. But there's many other ways as well.
Sure. So for those people, let's just say that there's people out there that are still a little uncomfortable. Maybe they're halfway through their pregnancy, and they're not going to start drinking raw milk now because whatever. And once they give birth and now they're nursing, is there a concern? Let's say that the mother does somehow get contaminated raw milk. Do the good antibodies then pass to the baby, or does the baby get contaminated as well?
Well, if the mother got sick, it would just not the baby wouldn't necessarily get sick. In fact, the baby would probably be immune to what the mother had. But really, Julie, the chances that a mother would get foodborne illness from raw milk in California are about zero.
Mm.
They literally are about zero. She is much more likely to get foodborne illness from lettuce or beef or chicken or something,
mm-hmm.
or mayonnaise than she is from raw milk. Raw milk is, first of all, in California, it's tested weekly, and secondly, it's got its own inbuilt safety system, which no other food does have.
Right, right. Well, I definitely agree with you. you know, there are people, because they've heard so much stuff about it, that they're not quite certain how to proceed, so I just, you know, we do our best.
I would just invite them to go to realmilk.com, and we have a PowerPoint presentation right on the splash page. So click on that. There's a lot of references. I'm just about to update it, as a matter of fact, because we found some more primary references. So.
Oh, great. And for those listening, if you want more information on raw dairy, we actually have Mark McAfee, who's the founder of Organic Pastures in California, who the company that Sally was saying sells has been selling raw milk since 1999. So he's going to be talking for a whole hour just on raw milk.
He's great to listen to.
Yes.
And what he's finding is a lot of help with asthma.
Mm.
You know, consumption of pasteurized milk is associated with asthma. And these asthmatic kids, very often, it just clears up when they get on raw milk.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So one last thing on fermented foods, and then I would just love to ask you a couple more questions on pregnancy and then talk more about healthy children and healthy babies.
Okay.
So kombucha is one of my favorite fermented foods. Everybody seems to love it. Kids love it. Adults love it. It has so many wonderful fermented properties. One of the amazing properties is it has some detoxification abilities.
Yes.
And so some of the concern, one of the great things about that is I've heard some very good results from some people that have had morning sickness that have used a little bit of it. I'm guessing it might have a little bit of subtle detoxification properties for extra hormones or things that are floating around in the system. But, of course, you don't want to detox while you're pregnant, and that's always the big concern with kombucha. So I'm curious, you and I had talked about this once, and you had mentioned that if the mother was drinking it before she was pregnant, it's still safe to continue doing so. So I wanted to get your...
Yes, that's what, when people ask me, that's what I tell them. If you've drunk kombucha before and you do fine with it, then it's a great thing to drink while you're pregnant. But occasionally someone will have a reaction to it, which I think is like a detoxification reaction. You don't want that to happen while you're pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to get used to these things before you get pregnant. Same with the raw milk. You should get used to it. Remember that milk is a food. It's not something that you gulp down in one big glass. You sip it slowly. It should be at room temperature. And so get used to all of these foods before you get pregnant. Learn to like pate or liverwurst so you can get your liver. Learn to take cod liver oil.
Mm-hmm.
All these things are very important. One thing I wanted to mention was back up to about the Second World War, the books that were published that gave recommendations on infant feeding recommended 2 teaspoons of cod liver oil starting at 3 months.
Wow.
So babies were getting cod liver oil before the Second World War.
Wow.
And that was a very healthy generation of people, and we need to go back to taking cod liver oil.
I definitely agree. So I have a class tonight. I'm teaching a pregnancy class.
Oh,
and
good.
One of my clients or the students in my class asked this question. I told her I would ask for her since I was going to talk to you today. So she was drinking kombucha for a long time before she ever got pregnant, but then she got pregnant and heard she wasn't supposed to. So for 5 months now that she's been pregnant, she hasn't been drinking it, but she's been wanting to. And my thought was, well, if you'd been drinking it before, and it's probably okay, but I thought, well, you know what, I'll check and see if Sally has any words of wisdom.
I would think it was fine. I would just tell her just to have a little sip, a couple little sips. Don't just gulp down a big glass.
Right,
It's
right.
much more important, though, that she be drinking raw milk than the kombucha.
Okay, very good. all right, so on from that, do you have any recommendations for foods that are really great for recovery, so things like recovering from childbirth and things? What nourishing foods would be really good to add to a diet for those women?
Well, cod liver oil is the first on my list, and raw milk second. Another wonderful food is broth, beautiful gelatinous bone broth.
Mm.
Good for calcium, restores the digestion, restores the strength. Very soothing, healing food. And I'm talking about broth and soups and sauces and stews and things like that.
And for people listening, the really important piece of that is to make it yourself or have a wonderful friend make it for you, because a lot of the commercial broths and sauces and all of those meat things, a lot of them have MSG, and that's the last thing that we want.
Absolutely, absolutely. You don't want to be taking in MSG. Now, one thing I really do caution mothers about while they're pregnant is don't eat any soy.
Mm-hmm.
The latest studies indicate that even small amounts of isoflavones cross the placenta, and that they're actually worse in small doses than large.
Wow.
So the rats who were exposed in this manner had behavioral changes, less social contact, higher indications of stress. So you really want to steer clear of the soy while you're pregnant.
Let's talk about that, because you know, one of the things that Weston A. Price found was that there weren't any vegan cultures. There were some that had a lot of vegetables and vegetable food, plant-based diets, but there were always some of these important animal foods like you had mentioned earlier. But there are people out there that use soy as one of their primary protein sources. So I think it's important to address for those people the reason that they're, some understanding of why they'd really want to cut that back.
Well, the first of all, soy is very difficult to digest. It is not a good source of protein. But my main concern is the estrogenic isoflavones. And, you know, we have a world where everything is estrogenated. The women have been on birth control pills for many years. They're highly estrogenated. The plastics, the pesticides are all estrogens. But these are nothing compared to what they get in the soy foods, which are very high in estrogens. So you really want to be careful, and I would just recommend, you know, a year before you get pregnant to try to just avoid all sources of these types of estrogen compounds. Get off the pill for a year and, you know, do follow your cycle so you know when to get pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And also then just avoid the soy.
In traditional cultures, in Asian cultures, they, you know, this is where our whole thing came up, that we were supposed to have massive amounts of soy. But we know that they didn't eat soy like that. In fact, they only used small amounts of very fermented, very processed soy, like a miso or something like that. Is, in your opinion, is soy inherently toxic, or is it when it's not processed properly?
Well, it is inherently toxic, and it has to be fermented to get rid of the toxins, but you never get rid of the isoflavones of the estrogens. And that's why in Asia they consume soy as a fermented food in very small amounts. It's just a myth that the Asians traditionally ate lots of soy. Now, it's being pushed on them in Asia just like it's being pushed on us here, so they're eating more today.
Right.
But in Asia, the average consumption in Japan was 2 tablespoons a day. Not very much. And in China, it was 2 teaspoons a day.
Wow.
And you have to remember also, soy is goitrogenic. It depresses thyroid function. The Asian diet is very supportive of the thyroid gland. There's lots of iodine, lots of vitamin A. So they could have a little soy in their diet and not have as many problems as we would have.
So talking about vitamin A, you mentioned the toxicity issue, and I want to go to that because that's always a big concern, especially when these multivitamins have very large amounts of synthetic vitamin A, and then people want to take the cod liver oil, and then they feel like, oh, I don't want to take extra cod liver oil, you know, I don't want too much vitamin A. So I know that the studies on that were very sparse, and I'm wondering if you can address the concern on vitamin A.
Yeah, well, first of all, we don't recommend multivitamins because they will contain the synthetic vitamin A, and the synthetic has been associated with certain types of birth defects. Especially when you consider that vitamin A is being added to processed foods, to things like margarine, which I hope none of your listeners would ever touch, but it's out there, a lot of synthetic vitamin A. So you don't want to take in the synthetic. You want the natural vitamin A, and we recently had one of our writers do a very large literature search on vitamin A toxicity. And it's fascinating what he came up with. Because there's a lot out there in the literature to work with. What he found was that if vitamin D was deficient, then vitamin A could be toxic. But as long as you got a threshold level of 1,000 units of vitamin D every day, then vitamin A is not toxic in any amount, even huge amounts. So the toxicity that you're seeing with vitamin A is actually a vitamin D toxicity, where the vitamin A needs vitamin A for a synergism, and so you get depleted of vitamin D. Anyway, so cod liver oil is the perfect solution. The brand that we recommend is, or the brands that we recommend are about 1,000 vitamin D and a half a teaspoon and 10,000 vitamin A.
And they can find that on your website.
Yes, there are 3 really good articles on cod liver oil on our website.
Great. And so let's go to, speaking of vitamin A, let's go to healthy babies. Mm-hmm. And so now we have a mother who's nursing, who's recovered nicely with her bone broths, and now she's having her cod liver oil. What other foods would a nursing mother want to consume? I'm guessing egg yolks.
Yes, lots of egg yolks. That's the choline, that's the DHA for brain development. And she'll have a smart baby. If she consumes egg yolks when she's pregnant and nursing and then makes egg yolks should be one of baby's first foods. And egg yolks and liver are first weaning foods for baby. And the liver has many important things in it. You know, babies, milk is not a particularly good source of iron for a growing baby. So after 6 months, the babies really need a high iron food, and that would be something like liver.
What I'm curious about this because I'm trying to think of evolution and nature, and if for other cultures, babies are nursed for several years and exclusively for, boy, hopefully a year or more.
No, that's a really big misconception.
Ah.
I don't know of any culture that nurses exclusively for a year.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, no, usually the babies get their first food at 4, 5, or 6 months, and it's usually liver that the mother has chewed for them.
Okay. Well, this is
and there's a very important reason for this, because in a natural situation, the baby would get all of the cord blood from the mother, and that provides a big chunk of vitamin B12 and iron and copper and everything that baby needs for healthy blood. But by 6 months, that's pretty used up.
Mm.
And you start to see anemia, very pale faces in these exclusively nursed babies. It's great if you can nurse for a year, 2 years, even 3 years. That's fine, but it shouldn't be baby's only food after 6 months.
Well, that makes a lot more sense to me, because I was trying to figure out why iron reserves would go down if, you know, traditionally that weren't the case. But now I understand.
Yeah.
That makes a lot more sense.
Now, by the way, at the same time, the baby shouldn't have a lot of iron in the first 6 months. Nature is so profoundly wise. because iron works antagonistically with zinc. Milk is very rich in zinc, and zinc is important for neurological development. So baby gets a burst of iron in the cord blood and B12 and all that, and then it doesn't get any iron to interfere with the absorption of zinc for 6 months. Then when it's just, you know, when the baby's about depleted of iron, that's when you start foods like liver. Egg yolks are a good source of iron as well.
And I know that in your book you talk about doing a very soft-boiled egg yolks where it's warm, but it's not really, by American standards, it certainly wouldn't be cooked.
Right.
So
you cook the egg till the white congeals. You don't want to give egg whites for quite some time because the whites could cause allergies.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another thing that we're very concerned about is giving children grains too early.
Mm.
The gut needs to become mature, the enzymes need to come online, and babies are not equipped to handle grains before a year. And I would really say wait till 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because of all the celiac disease and gluten intolerance I'm hearing about.
Definitely. And, you know, of course, that's one of the very, very first foods they usually suggest.
Oh, I know. The cereal, and you just add water and
yeah.
It's just starch and
right.
gluten.
So when people do start to introduce grains for their baby, fermenting them or soaking and getting those enzymes and everything activated is important. Do you, when they do start to introduce grains, do you have a thought of whether it's a gluten grain or a non-gluten grain, and whether, because I know in your nourishing traditions you have a recipe for the cereal gruel, and that is and that's fermented.
Right, that's a gluten grain. It's not a high gluten grain. It's a gluten grain. And what we say is to kind of grind it up real small and soak it overnight in warm water plus something acidic added. And then you cook them the next morning and add butter or cream or a little pinch of salt, maybe a little bit of honey or maple syrup or something like that. But oats, actually, when they're soaked like that, they have substances that are really good for digestion.
Mm. What about other non-gluten grains, things like rice or quinoa? What about introducing those first if you're concerned about gluten?
Well, I would still wait for a year to
mm-hmm.
introduce rice. And rice is a good food to introduce at first. It's a good grain to introduce as the first grain. Now, quinoa you have to be careful with because it does need to be soaked. It's toxic if it's not soaked.
So could you take any of these grains, rice, quinoa, any of them, could you soak them overnight? Could you then dry them and then powder them, or do you recommend grinding them and then soaking them?
And they
after?
Need to be cooked.
Yes, of course.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So there, I can see there's sort of two ways to do it. You can grind the grain and then soak it and then cook it, or you can soak it, sort of almost kind of sprouting it a little bit. Just soak it and then dry it and then grind it. So,
yes, I guess you could do that too.
Either way, whatever.
But you need the two things. You need the soaking and the cooking.
Got it. Yes. Grains are definitely.
Now, we have a really great article we posted recently on our website. If you go to WestonAPrice.org and click on Children's Health, it's an article about feeding babies, and it starts with the 6 months and goes through, you know, through up until about 2 years. Lots of wonderful recipes.
Okay.
Yeah, pureed meats, and there's pureed fish, and there's pureed liver, and the egg yolks and the fruits. And custards are great food for baby, too.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
So, let's see here. In your opinion, first foods would not be grains. They'd be egg yolks, liver. Any other thoughts about...
Well, meat. It can be meat, raw dairy.
Mm-hmm.
You can do some... things like potato with butter on them. Bananas are good food. Bananas have a lot of enzymes.
Mm.
Very easy for babies to digest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's just talk a little bit about, I actually had a call from somebody on the way over here, so I thought, you know, this is actually a really good question to ask. So she has a baby, and the parents are both small, and the baby has always been on the low side of the size, weight, height, weight chart, and they weren't too concerned, but now the baby's kind of dropped off the chart, so they're kind of below the chart. So
yeah.
My question is, you know, how important is this chart, and were babies, traditionally fed babies, were they smaller than regular babies, or is there something that at this point, a baby that's on the small side, that we could do to really boost up the nutrients for that person?
Yeah, what is the baby being fed?
You know, that I don't know,
yeah.
Because I just talked
to them. I would be concerned if the baby's too small, especially if the baby's too thin. Babies are supposed to be fat, chubby, round, and sturdy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, whether they're big or medium or a little small, they should be sturdy and chubby, nice layer of fat on them. So I would be very concerned about that, and I would say go to our website and read about feeding babies. Get that baby on good fats, good raw milk, meat and liver and so forth.
Great. I want to talk about the common... advice that's given out there, because you just mentioned the good fats. I understand, which shocks me, but I understand that it's true that they tell moms that after 2 years old you should go to low-fat milk.
Yeah. This is genocide. I don't mind saying this. This is a genocidal diet. Children need animal fats. They need the types of molecules that are in animal fats, and they need the types of vitamins that are in animal fats. In large amounts, right through their growing years, right up through age 21, they need them for healthy bones, they need them for reproduction, they need them for their brains. And we are reaping the whirlwind with this epidemic of learning disabilities and autism and so forth, because we have bought into this horrible low-fat message. And no traditional culture ate that way. What people wanted were the fats. They recognized the fats were very important. So babies... in particular, they need butter, they need egg yolks. If you're feeding them meat, they need fat on the meat, they need cream.
Hmm.
They need things cooked in fat. It's and not vegetable oils.
Mm-hmm.
They need the animal fat.
Mm-hmm.
And coconut oil is another good fat for babies.
Mm.
Very protective. It protects the baby. It encourages the right kind of flora in the gut. So all of these are important fats for babies.
Wonderful. And let's talk about adults. Does it differ that much? I mean, there are many, many adults and, of course, pregnant women and all sorts of people that are, let's just not even assume pregnant women. Let's assume that we consider them in the category with babies because they're growing a baby. But what about the rest of everybody? Everybody I know drinks non-fat or eats non-fat and low-fat dairy products.
Except Weston A. Price Foundation
members. Of course.
You know, ask yourself, why did Mother Nature put fat in the milk? There's a reason for it, and one of the reasons is that the vitamins in the fat are what you need to assimilate the minerals in the milk. You need vitamin A in the butter fat to assimilate calcium and protein. And what happens if you're drinking a lot of skim milk? You're getting a huge amount of calcium that the body doesn't know what to do with because it's not getting the components it needs to use that calcium properly, and the calcium ends up in the wrong place. instead of going to the bones, it ends up in the arteries or your joints.
Mm.
And that you do not want that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just incredible what has happened, the way we have turned our backs on the things that people used to recognize as being important for our health, such as butter and cream.
And, in fact, in your latest book, you talk a lot about the importance of eating fat and how eating fat doesn't make you fat.
That's exactly right. Yeah, there's studies on this. You know, you're much more likely to get fat from carbohydrates
mm-hmm.
or vegetable oils than you are from the animal fats.
Right.
And butter, if the butter comes from cows eating grass, has an anti-weight gain component to it, which is called CLA, and the fat on your beef and the fat on the lamb. Very rich in CLA, which helps you build muscle rather than fat.
Any thoughts for people out there? Because I think most dairy products, people wouldn't know if they're fed grass. And I think that most people assume that if it's organic, that it's probably fed grass. And that's not true in most cases. How can people identify a source that would be grass-fed?
Well, we have, of course, organic pastures dairy in California. And they're absolutely wonderful, and they're sold in many stores. Now, also, our local chapters may have other sources. More local sources, and just go to westonaprice.org.
Mm-hmm.
We have at least 20 chapters in California and many in the Bay Area. So click on that. We have folks who've forged links with local farms, and you want to go that route.
And that does remind me that in San Francisco we have the Weston A. Price San Francisco spelled out .org, and they have all sorts of information on egg, you know, sources for egg, pastured eggs, and those kinds of things. So, in our last few minutes together, I just wanted to get some more information on how people can find out more about you and find out about how they can learn more.
Okay. Well, first of all, the Weston A. Price Foundation is a wonderful resource, and our emphasis is on children's health, and we're at westonaprice.org. And Weston is spelled WestonAprice.org. I would really encourage your listeners to visit our website and find out about our upcoming conference, which is in November. November is on Veterans Day weekend. We have a wonderful time. We give CEUs for health professionals, and it's just a great way to meet people and hear about our work. We have a quarterly magazine for members, so I highly encourage your listeners to become members. And we publish a shopping guide that provides brand names of products that we recommend and lots of very concise, easy-to-read educational literature. So that's the Weston A. Price Foundation, and one of our websites is realmilk.com, which gives you sources of raw milk throughout the country. And then the other website I'd recommend is my little publishing company, newtrendspublishing.com. And that's N-E-W-T-R-E-N-D-S, publishing.com. My book, Nourishing Traditions, is there, and many other books on diet and health.
And if you don't have Nourishing Traditions, everybody should have a copy of that. It's, as a nutrition consultant, it's one of the staple books of most of my colleagues that I know. So.
Thank you.
In our, you know, I just wanted to, you're talking about community, and we have a couple more minutes, and I just wanted to find out. So, giving some people some background, there are hundreds of chapters, thousands of members that have been applying these principles. There are many groups and Yahoo groups specifically associated or out there to support healthy babies and pregnant women. So is there a place that people can go, or do you have, I guess I want to give the listener audience some sense of that the community of people that is doing this, since they might be the only person they've ever met that's going to feed raw milk to their baby. It might be a little bit,
It's daunting, and there's a lot of disapproval sometimes.
Right.
Well, go to westonaprice.org and click on local chapters. Find the San Francisco chapter. This is a very vibrant chapter that has cooking classes, group meetings, and they have put together a wonderful program called Nourishing Our Children, which is a PowerPoint presentation that's being given in the schools, and they have a little manual that goes with that, and that's just a wonderful resource and a great group of people to be involved with.
Thank you. I'm actually on the board, so for all those people, that was a nice plug for us. It's nourishingourchildren.org.
Right.
And there's also some great Yahoo groups out there that are specifically for healthy babies and pregnant women.
Yes, in fact, if you go to WestonAPrice.org and click on WebWatch, we have some of those Yahoo groups.
Great. So what other last tidbits, if you're going to talk to a soon-to-be family or an aspiring family, what do you want to tell them?
Well, I would tell them to read Dr. Price's book, Nutrition and Physical Degeneration. I think that's a very important book because you see the photographs, you see what happens when people start to eat the wrong type of diet.
It is pretty interesting, and people think that that's just cosmetic, but that's just what we see on the outside.
Okay.
It's just an external representation of the health on the inside.
But, you know, we shouldn't sneer at cosmetic either. It is a child's birthright to be physically attractive,
right,
to be strong and healthy and have a good mind, all the connections in the mind, and to be physically attractive. And that is the way we're all designed to be. Whether we end up that way depends on the building materials used when this child is being formed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the food that we eat. So that part's up to the parents. And so you need to be informed about what the good foods are.
Mm-hmm. And one of our favorite foods, or one of the really important foods, is calcium. So, of course, raw dairy is going to be loaded with calcium and the enzymes to help absorb that. And the bone broths that you mentioned earlier, anything else that you can think of for calcium that would be essential or helpful for the absorption?
Well, one thing we came up with in Eat Fat, Lose Fat was our coconut milk tonic for people who were allergic to dairy or, you know, really didn't want to make bone broth. It has the same calories, fat, and calcium as whole milk. And it's made with whole coconut milk, a little bit of maple syrup, and some dolomite powder, which is calcium carbonate. And that's added to it. So that's a really quick drink. A lot of mothers take that when they're traveling for their kids.
Okay.
Love it, yeah.
And speaking of children that truly are casein intolerant, some of them is we've assumed or know through studies that people that consume raw dairy don't have the same reaction that people that as they do to pasteurized dairy. But for those babies where really they do have a true casein intolerance and they can't do dairy at all, you have a wonderful meat-based formula that's on your website that I think is just such a savior to people that can't do dairy because their only options really are cow formula or soy formula. And then if they do a hypoallergenic, quote, they use corn, which is, to me, the most allergenic.
Well, also, and it's full of MSG because it's very hydrolyzed. I guess we didn't mention, Julie, that I do have recipes for baby formula in my book, and these are for mothers who, for whatever reason, can't or aren't nursing, and, you know, there's no opprobrium here. Everyone has her own reason. And these formulas are based on raw goat milk, raw cow milk, and or the liver and broth that's pureed together. And you have to follow the recipes exactly because they were designed to imitate mother's milk, but using real whole foods. And these formula recipes have saved lots of babies. We have so many grateful parents.
Definitely. So those recipes that you created, you're looking at the profile of the human milk, and then you were coming up with ways of imitating that.
Right, fatty acid profile and everything. If you go to Children's Health, you'll find those charts.
Great. Well, Sally, thank you again for being here today. It was such a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure, Julie, and thanks for what you're doing and getting the word out to people. You know, we're going to have a new generation of really healthy children following these dietary principles.
Yes.
And that's what keeps us going, is seeing these beautiful babies.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Julie.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, you are listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You're listening to Reality Sandwich. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant. And you can find out more information about me at healthfulliving.org. And you can find any of our radio shows, including this one, downloadable at, you can either go to my website, healthfulliving.org, or you can go directly to realitysandwichradio.com. And following on this conversation, I have a cooking class that starts, it's actually a one-day class on June 10th, which is a Saturday, and we are going to be talking about how to make these bone broths, how to work with raw dairy, how to make your own raw yogurt or kefir, how to make some of these fermented foods, the raw sauerkraut, kombucha, and all of those, as well as soaking and fermenting your grains and your nuts. And a lot of the principles we talked about today I'm going to be teaching in my cooking class. So you can find that at healthfulliving.org. You are listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Connecting the Dots.